The fact that it was Will made the choice easier. It wasn't that Arthur disliked him as such. Will was quite fun. It was just that he was fun in such an exhausting way, because being in advertising, he always wanted you to know how much fun he was having, and where he'd got his jacket from. Mindful of this, Arthur hid behind a van. "Hey, no nothing, what's up?" The door opened and Will came out, wearing a leather flying jacket that he'd got a mate of his at the Road Research Laboratory to crash a car into, especially, in order to get that battered look. No nothing yelped with delight, and having got the attention it wanted, was happy to forget Arthur. Will was with some friends, and they had a game they played with the dog. "Commies!" they all shouted at the dog in chorus. "Commies! Commies! Commies!" The dog went berserk with barking, prancing up and down, yapping its little heart out beside itself in transports of ecstatic rage. They all laughed and cheered it on, then gradually dispersed to their various cars and disappeared into the night. "Well, that clears one thing up," thought Arthur from behind the van. "This is quite definitely the planet I remember." Chapter 7. His house was still there. How or why, he had no idea. He had decided to go and have a look while he was waiting for the pub to empty, so that he could go and ask the landlord for a bed for the night when everyone else had gone. And there it was. He hurriedly let himself in with a key he kept under a stone frog in the garden, because, astoundingly, the phone was ringing. He had heard it faintly all the way up the lane, and started to run as soon as he realized where the sound was coming from. The door had to be forced open because of the astonishing accumulation of junk mail on the doormat. It jammed itself stuck on what he would later discover were 14 identical, personally addressed invitations to apply for a credit card he already had, 17 identical threatening letters for non-payment of bills on a credit card he didn't have, 33 identical letters saying that he personally had been specially selected as a man of taste and discrimination, who knew what he wanted and where he was going in today's sophisticated jet-setting world, and would he therefore like to buy some grotty wallet. And also a dead tabby kitten. He rammed himself through the relatively narrow opening afforded by all this, stumbled through a pile of wine offers that no discriminating connoisseur would want to miss, slithered over a heap of beach villa holidays, blundered up the dark stairs to his bedroom, and got to the phone just as it stopped ringing. He collapsed panting onto his cold, musty-smelling bed, and for a few minutes stopped trying to prevent the world from spinning round his head in the way it obviously wanted to. When it had enjoyed its little spin and had calmed down a bit, Arthur reached out for his bedside light, not expecting it to come on. To his surprise, it did. This appealed to Arthur's sense of logic. Since the electricity board cut him off without fail every time he paid his bill, it seemed only reasonable that they should leave him connected when he didn't. Sending them money obviously only drew attention to yourself. The room was much as he had left it, i.e. festeringly untidy, though the effect was muted a little by a thick layer of dust. Half-read books and magazines nestled amongst piles of half-used towels. Half pairs of socks reclined in half-drunk cups of coffee. What was once a half-eaten sandwich had now half-turned into something that Arthur entirely didn't want to know about. Bung a fork of lightning through this lot, he thought to himself, and he'd start the evolution of life off all over again. There was only one thing in the room that was different. For a moment or so he couldn't see what the one thing was that was different, because it too was covered in a film of disgusting dust. Then his eyes caught it and stopped. It was next to a battered old television, on which it was only possible to watch open university study courses, because if it tried to show anything more exciting, it would break down. It was a box. Arthur pushed himself up on his elbows and peered at it. It was a grey box with a kind of dull lustre to it. It was a cubic grey box, just over a foot on a side. It was tied with a single grey ribbon, knotted into a neat bow on the top. He got up, walked over, and touched it in surprise. Whatever it was clearly gift-wrapped, neatly and beautifully, and was waiting for him to open it. Cautiously, he picked it up and carried it back to the bed. He brushed the dust off the top and loosened the ribbon. The top of the box was a lid, with a flap tucked into the body of the box. He untucked it and looked into the box. In it was a glass globe, nestling in fine grey tissue paper. He drew it out carefully. It wasn't a proper globe because it was open at the bottom, or, as Arthur realized turning it over, at the top, with a thick rim. It was a bowl, a fish bowl. It was made of the most wonderful glass, perfectly transparent, yet with an extraordinary silver-grey quality, as if crystal and slate had gone into its making. Arthur slowly turned it over and over in his hands. It was one of the most beautiful objects he had ever seen, but he was entirely perplexed by it. He looked into the box, but other than the tissue paper, there was nothing. On the outside of the box, there was nothing. He turned the bowl round again. It was wonderful. It was exquisite. But it was a fish bowl. He tapped it with his thumbnail, and it rang with a deep and glorious chime, which was sustained for longer than seemed possible. And when at last it faded, seemed not to die away, but to drift off into other worlds, as into a deep sea dream.